So for this morning, we're going to look at the last of the five indriyas, and that's the panindriya, or the faculty of wisdom or understanding. And for this morning, I'd like to give just a little bit of background and perspective on what wisdom is considered to be in Buddhism, as well as some hints of how to practice it in meditation. Most of you, I think, have done some form of vipassana meditation, which is a kind of meditation that is aimed at developing wisdom. So you have some idea of what this involves. So I'm going to just sort of take a step back and have a bit of a look at it and how it works, how it all works in context. Now, in Buddhism, specifically in the early Buddhist texts, wisdom is a pragmatic function of the mind whose purpose is to enable us to let go, specifically to let go of those things that give rise to suffering. And it is not something that has like a single particular application, but rather is something that guides and informs everything that we do. Wisdom begins with listening or reading or thinking about the Dhamma, or it begins with some kind of experience or reflection, or it begins because sometimes the truth is forced upon us when we least expect it. So whatever the original source of that wisdom is, somehow for wisdom to matter, there has to be some kind of connection. Or should I say perhaps rather, there's a difference between, say, perhaps we could make a distinction between knowledge and wisdom. And knowledge might be something that somebody could learn in a course about Buddhism, where they could learn information about the Buddha and the Buddha's teachings and so on. But that doesn't necessarily make any difference in terms of their actual understanding and the suffering in their life. So we can have a kind of a knowledge which might be perfectly fine in and of itself, but wisdom is a kind of knowledge that means something. It's a kind of knowledge that matters. So, how does this work? Why is this kind of, how does this knowledge get synthesized and how does it get applied? If we think about what wisdom means, forgetting the Buddhist context for now, we think about the ordinary context out in the world. What do we mean when we say somebody is a wise person? And what kind of things are we looking to a wise person for? A wise person isn't necessarily the best informed person. I mean, we would hope that a wise person was at least reasonably well informed, but they might not be an expert on everything. A wise person need not be the most intelligent person. There's lots of very intelligent people in the world who do lots of extremely stupid things all the time. A wise person need not be the person who is regarded as an expert in the field or an authority. Because expertise and authority can be gained by a lot of means, and wisdom is often not among those things. So if we look for somebody who's wise, what kind of thing are we looking for? Well, I think it has a number of different kind of dimensions. Partly, if we think of somebody as wise, partly it has an ethical dimension. That we believe that somebody who's wise would be somebody who acts with integrity. Right? I mean, we wouldn't be surprised if we would find, say, an intelligent person who was also a thief. or who was engaged in a fraud or a scam or something like that. This kind of thing happens all the time. But we would be kind of surprised to find a wise person doing that. Right? So wisdom, in the idea of wisdom, it contains some kind of idea of an ethical integrity. Wisdom also contains something about some kind of emotional content to it as well. And part, I think part of the important meaning of wisdom is that it contains a way of applying knowledge that is restrained and compassionate and sympathetic. I'm reminded of a book that was published many years ago now, where the Dalai Lama was invited to give some commentary on some Bible verses. A Christian group invited him to come and make a commentary. They gave him some Bible readings from the Gospels and asked him to come and say some words on it. And it was very interesting because they chose some interesting passages, including some quite challenging ones. For example, they gave him the passage on where Jesus was sitting with his disciples and his mother comes along and says, you know, come home and with your family. And Jesus says, no, these are my family. And that's a kind of a challenging passage, right? And it would be very easy to interpret that in a way that was kind of hostile. But when Dalai Lama gave his interpretation of it, he gave a very compassionate reading of all of these kinds of passages. And in each case, he was able to find something within those passages that was meaningful and that brought forth some wisdom. So this is, I think, a good example of how compassion and wisdom are very closely related. So these are some aspects of wisdom that has something to do, something that's has some integrity, it has some compassion. I think wisdom is also very humble. Okay, so knowledge and intellect and so on are often very, like people like to put them on display. So people have a high IQ, they like to join Mensa or something like that, so they can kind of put it on their Twitter account and say, here I am, I'm very smart. As somebody who's wise doesn't necessarily advertise that on their Facebook account. So wisdom, humility, and there's something about wisdom that isn't pushy. And somebody who's wise listens a lot, as opposed to being somebody who knows all the answers all the time. And again, I kind of, a recent example of that really struck me was an article I read some weeks ago about Bernie Sanders. And one of the things Bernie Sanders was known for was for making long speeches. In fact, I think he gave a speech in the Congress. It was like 8 hours long or something at one point. And they made the kind of whole long book out of it called The Speech. And he was really kind of known for being kind of, you know, lecturing people and having this kind of hectoring tone. And for one of the criticisms of him was that he would always sort of give the same speech whenever he was doing things. And if people would ask him a question, he'd just give the speech at them rather than really listening to their question. But what this article was saying that in the recent campaign is actually completely changed. And that what he does now is that he often hardly talks at all, but he invites other people to speak, and he just gives them an opportunity to speak. And when I read that, I thought, that's amazing, right? It's amazing to find somebody who, with all due respect, is somewhat advanced in age, and has been doing this for a long time and is willing to make that kind of radical change. And to me, that's the difference that wisdom makes, that wisdom is not pushing its own ideas all the time but is very open to listening to where other people are coming from. And a wise word or a wise voice gives a few words at the right time rather than thinking it has to be a lot of words all the time. So these are some characteristics. Another characteristic of wisdom is that wisdom is practical. So wisdom, wise people don't get too carried away with theories and speculation. They don't get caught up in conspiracy theories. They don't get caught up in, second guessing people's intentions. Right? This is something that happens a lot. People will write something or they say something and people are second guessing. Why did they do that? Why did they say that? A wise person doesn't get into that. So a wise person also has an understanding that has an understanding of the variety of people and the variety of people's potentials. And so with that, it gives the capacity to be able to see what a person's strengths are and to draw those things out. When I was in India many years ago, we were doing some work with the Sangha there, and one of the problems that they have in India with the Indian Sangha is that there's very little education, very little training, and that very often monks and nuns will come along and they just kind of ordain, and they don't know anything, like literally really don't know anything. And they maybe only read one book on Buddhism, maybe read the Dhammapada or read Ambedkar's book on Buddhism. And that's it. That's all they really know. But they ordain and they want to practice. And they don't know how to keep vinaya. They don't know any of the rules or any of the behaviors or anything like that. And so this is kind of a problem we tried to address when we were there in just some small ways. But I remember talking with somebody, and I can't remember who it was now, one of the monks who was there. And he said, two really good points about the Sangha in India, about the Indian monks and Indian nuns, is two things. One thing is that they have a lot of faith, and secondly, that they have really good memories. They can memorize suttas and things really well. And so that person, I can't remember who it was who said that, but that person really kind of saw, actually, when I saw that, you think, these are really good qualities. And once you see that, you can begin to build on that. But that, of course, doesn't mean that a wise person is always Pollyanna-ish. So wisdom doesn't just see the positive side of things. And this is something that I think has got way over the top in modern times. And there's a kind of a history of this, but the kind of the whole doctrine of positive psychology and positive thinking, which was in the States, was pushed into schools based on supposed evidence, which turned out to be not really there at all. And the idea that you always have to look on the positive side of things. And more recent psychology has shown that, in fact, that often doesn't work. And surprise, people are different. And some people need positive reinforcement and other people need realistic and balanced criticism. And so, as so often with these things, you have this new truth that reveals something you didn't think you knew, and then afterwards you realize, no, that wasn't true, and what I thought I knew was probably pretty much right all along. So wisdom has that kind of sense of balance. Wisdom's also quite happy to look at negative things and look at criticisms and look at the dark side of things and without getting too wrapped up in it. And so from a position of wisdom, you're not focused on that kind of question of what is the emotional content of something. I guess if something isn't true because I like it. If something's true, it's true. It's real. I accept it, and then you learn how to deal with it. So, all of these. Another characteristic of wisdom is that wisdom is not easily swayed by things that are of the moment, and a wise person doesn't get too caught up in trends. They don't just change their views because it happens to be the fashion that week, nor do they reject things that are new, and they're willing to be open and learn that if there is something that's new that they're able to learn from, then they can learn from that. But they're not just going to just do it just because. So All of these are kind of characteristics, I would say, generally of wisdom or of a wise person that I think most people in the world would probably think that this is kind of what wisdom is. I don't think these specifically are Buddhist things. Now, if we look at specifically Buddhist approach, then Buddhism says that, let's have a look at, first of all, let's have a look at how Buddhism says knowledge is gained, and the gaining of knowledge in Buddhism. This is something which is actually very consistent throughout the Buddhist tradition, and except in recent years in the 20th century is often presented in quite a different way. So I wanted to just mention this briefly for you in passing. Again, one of those things where it's important to understand the historical shift. According to the early Buddhist text and according to all of the Buddhist traditions, there are basically two ways of gaining knowledge. The first way is through direct experience and the second way is through inference. And every Buddhist tradition has maintained this and agreed with this. And in the 20th century, it's quite common to find people who will completely dismiss the role of inference and will point to only direct knowledge as being a source of wisdom. Inference. I'll talk about that more in a minute. Yeah. So, the suttas So in modern times, I'm not exactly sure why, but I think partly what happened in the 20th century was that the Buddhist idea that wisdom should be drawn from experience was regarded as something which was new and radical, rather than the idea that wisdom was something drawn from books. And so that idea that we should focus on the direct experience things was emphasized a lot in the Zen circles and in certain of the Vipassana circles and various other people who are influenced by those ideas. And it comes to be this idea that you just have awareness of what's happening in the present, and then that's your kind of wisdom and that's your insight. But when you reflect on it, you realize, well, actually this can't be the case at all. I should mention that there are terms and ideas in the Dhamma which are then used to justify this interpretation. For example, the term akaliko, which we recite in our morning chanting, which some people interpret as meaning timeless. But in fact, akaliko doesn't really mean timeless. What akaliko means is that the results of your practice will appear without you having to wait for them. In other words, that you can realistically observe the results of your practice. It doesn't actually mean that Dhamma hasn't got anything to do with time, because obviously the Buddha was recollecting his past lives and various other things which obviously have to do with time. So, direct knowledge, or pachaka, and inference, or anumana, are the two pramanas, or two ways of knowing. These are found and mentioned quite commonly in the suttas. It's not really formalized in the suttas, but it became formalized in the later doctrines, and especially in the school that's known as the epistemological school of Dignaga and others, who developed an extremely sophisticated philosophy of epistemology and ways of knowing, philosophies that I'm only vaguely aware of. So if you want to know more about those, you probably have to come here and study with some of the Tibetan teachers, because they study some of those texts in a lot of detail. But in the suttas, the basic idea is straightforward. There's direct knowledge and there's inference. What do we mean by these things? Well, direct knowledge is where you are aware of something that's occurring in the present. And the obvious example would be if I look at something and then I see something and I see a sight, and that's something that I'm aware of in the present. It's a direct knowledge. Inference is something which I can draw from or infer from that direct knowledge. So let's say I look at that chandelier hanging from the ceiling, and I can see that, and I can see that the wire is fraying and it's about to fall off. and I can infer that somebody sitting underneath it is going to have a sore head, okay? And both of these are regarded as being essential to the development of wisdom. And I think this is really important to know, because often, again, as I say, often in the present day, people will say, oh, you can't rely on inference, but you can only rely on that direct knowledge. And this is simply not true, either according to the Buddha's teaching or according to any Buddhist tradition. Why? Well, first of all, let's start to think about it. Think about what's the borderline between direct knowledge and inference. It's not as obvious as you might think. Okay, so if I look and I see that chandelier, actually, I don't see that chandelier. What I see is light. And the chandelier is already an inference. That's a concept in my mind. So I don't look and see chandeliers at all. I look and I just see light. What about shape? Chandelier, the light thing there? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. Just a convenient thing to look at. So what do I actually, to what extent is what I see a product of the raw data of that visual data, and to what extent is it already pre-processed by my perception and thus have to do with inference and not just into the raw data of experience? The dividing line between those things is not entirely obvious, and one of the disputes in the Buddhist traditions later on was about exactly how to draw these boundaries. So leaving that aside, we don't want to get too much into the philosophical ideas, but the basic idea I think should be clear enough that we have, the present gives us in some ways the raw data of experience, and this is that kind of direct perception, but then we draw inferences from that. Now, the experience of insight in meditation, or vipassana, or discernment in meditation, necessarily requires inference, and it cannot be just based on direct experience. Why? Well, we discussed this a little bit a few days ago when we talked about impermanence, and impermanence is something that evolves over time. It necessarily involves time. That's the whole point. Something is there at one time, and at a later time, it's not there. But time is just a concept. Time doesn't actually exist. And we're not aware of time, and we can't see the impermanence of something. You don't see impermanence. What you see is something is there. There's some phenomenon which is present in your mind, and you see that. Then later on, you have another experience in your mind. And your memory connects those two experiences and says, oh, this thing was there, this feeling was there in me before, and now it's not there in me. And you infer from that that feeling was impermanent. So the understanding of impermanence is essentially inferential. And this is why that same knowledge that you can apply to the feelings that are changing inside your own body and own experience, you can then infer that even further, for example, to contemplate the impermanence of the people that you love, to contemplate the impermanence of all the physical things in this structure, even though we can't actually see that. But because the understanding of impermanence arrives from inference, we can infer that and we can imagine what that's like. We can even imagine the impermanence of the whole universe, as the Buddha talks about in the suttas quite frequently. So, what then is the relationship between direct experience and inference? Well, the Buddha's emphasis was similar to what's known in Western philosophy as empiricism. And that is to say that basically the idea of empiricism is that firstly, we need to be guided in what we seek by some pre-existing hypothesis or idea. Right? So we have some idea that's directing us to look in a certain direction. So for an empirical scientist, then their idea might be to look at, say, what are the rainfall patterns in this part of Belgium, and then they will do the experiments. But you have to have some idea beforehand to guide your experiment. The same thing in Buddhism. We might have some idea. I want to understand why it is that I come here to seek peace and I end up just being really annoyed by things all the time. All right? So this is the framework for your experiment. So that's going to guide and shape your experience. All right? So this is an idea. It's a concept. Then you look, okay, what's that feeling like? Then you have the direct experience of that feeling. So this is like the information or the data that the scientist is gathering based on their hypothesis. They look, oh, what is that feeling? Ah, okay, I experience it. And you look at that. And you, as you look at it over and over again, you start to discern patterns. You see, if you just see a feeling coming up at one point and then going, it doesn't really mean anything. But when you see, oh, actually, when I think about that person, then this feeling comes up. And, that's a pattern, and you recognize that. Oh, okay, so then why is that? What is it that I'm thinking about that person that creates that feeling? Huh? And then you look into that. So this is starting to guide your insight. So the insight arises from experience, but then we make the inference from the experience. And once we have the inference from our experience, then that can guide us to direct our experience once more and to gain even more wisdom and more insight. So this is how the process works, the process of inquiry, of gathering information through direct experience in meditation. Then we make inferences, and then that guides our further exploration and further inquiry. Now, don't mistake me. When I say making an inference, I'm not talking about necessarily making a conscious and rational thing. In fact, not at all. Right? Let me reflect for a little while on how inference works. Now, let's imagine that you're at school and you write on the board 2 + 2 = and then one of the kids has to write down the answer on the board, right? Now, they write down the number 4. Where does that come from? And if I say to you now, what's 2 + 2, then the number 4 comes into your mind. Where does it come from? When we see that written on a blackboard, it seems like it's a rational process where everything is explicit. But the reality is, in your mind, the answer is not there, and then it is. And that's all you can say about it. And it's very weird. Because this happens to us like all the time. If somebody asks you a simple question, you know, what time is the meal time today? And you give them the answer, if you know the answer. Where does that come from? You say, well, it comes from my memory. But that doesn't answer anything. That's just a word that you're using for it. In your experience and in your mind, the answer isn't there, and then it is. And when the answer comes to a problem, there's something about it that has a quality of rightness to it. I mean, it might not be right, right? But it feels to us like it is. When we get the answer to something, and it feels good. There's a positive emotional tone to it. Some problem that we're struggling, it comes. This is how inference works. Inference is happening in our subconscious all the time, and it's kind of working away at stuff, and then it kind of presents us the answer. And that's exactly what happens to us in meditation, except, of course, in meditation, things start happening at a much deeper and deeper level. So, just as in a maths class you might draw an inference as to what the answer of a problem is, and the answer appears to you in your mind and it has a sense of rightness to it, the same thing happens to you in your meditation. You might be like, why is it that my mind feels agitated right now? And then you can ask that question and you have an insight into it, and then you can let go of it. And when you let go of it, if you get the answer right in your classroom, then you get a positive feedback. The teacher says, well done, Johnny. Have an apple. Okay? And if the same thing happens in your... I know, it's just an example, right? If the same thing happens in your meditation, then also you get a reward for it. You get an apple. So the apple is the peace of mind that comes when you can answer those questions that really matter. And so when you meditate, you apply your mind, you do these kinds of practices, and then at a certain point that you can't really predict, the answer comes to you. And when the answer comes to you, there's like a release, and it feels good. It feels happy. So what's happening when those things happen is that you're drawing together this wide variety of information, this wide variety of experiences, the direct experience. And you've observed a pattern in that direct experience, and then you can put that all together and you can say, oh, I understand it. I know what's going on with that direct experience. This is how wisdom works. And so that wisdom is working constantly in your meditation, and it's constantly, gradually growing there. Now, the faculty of wisdom, because we're talking about the faculties now, the faculty, remember I talked about earlier in the retreat that the idea of a faculty or an indriya is bound up with the idea of some kind of innate potential or capacity which can be drawn out or stimulated in the right contexts. So, obviously, people have a different capacity for wisdom, just as they have a different capacity for other things. It doesn't mean that some people don't have wisdom. Everyone has wisdom and everyone can develop it, but people are at different stages in that developing of it. What's the defining feature here? Well, think about that idea that I said before of the patterns and recognizing the patterns. Really, the basic distinction is very simple. The more wisdom that you have, the fewer times you need to see that pattern happening before you can draw the conclusion. Yeah? That's really the essence of wisdom. And so somebody who has a lot of intelligence, but not necessarily wisdom, will then, conceit will get involved, and they'll tend to overestimate that, and they'll start jumping to conclusions. Right? That's somebody who lets the conceit go in, where someone whose wisdom knows the right time, right? They know how many times they know when that understanding arises. And how do we know that? What's the confirmation of that? The confirmation of that is that we let go. Now, these stages, these different aspects of wisdom are also described in another teaching. Again, this teaching is not found explicitly in the suttas, but it's found in the later tradition, but it's actually embodied in the suttas in many different ways. But the basic idea is it's a very interesting and useful framework for understanding vipassana meditation. If you've done vipassana and studied the different vipassana teachings, then you'll know that they have a kind of a long and very elaborate system of different stages of insight. Right? Now, for those of us who find that all of those many stages of insight is too many to remember them all, then I'm just going to give you three stages of insight. And then that will be nice and simple, and we can all remember that. Right? So the first stage of insight is what they call jnata parinya, which is understanding the known. And understanding the known is just a technical term, but what it means is that direct experience that I was talking about just now. So this is where in our meditation we get that clear, direct experience of what exactly is happening right now. So this means the first stage, the first step in developing wisdom in your meditation is to have a very clear idea of what is happening right now. And there are various frameworks which the Buddha gave for doing this. Probably the easiest one to use for meditation is the six senses. And so how we would apply that is that you would look at each of the six senses in turn and spend time with that, contemplating, being aware of that particular sense until you clearly know what that is like. What is seeing like? What is hearing like? What is smelling like? And staying with that experience for a long, long time until you can clearly distinguish that particular sense consciousness. And you can compare the different kinds of consciousness, and you realize that each of the kinds of consciousness that we have is quite a different kind of thing. So this is the jnata parinya. It's getting to know the thing in and of itself, and this is connected with that idea of that direct experience, direct awareness. Second stage of insight is the dhirana parinya, which means the understanding by scrutiny, Again, don't worry too much about these technical terms, but what it means here is essentially that kind of inferential knowledge that I was just talking about. So understanding by scrutiny means that you reflect on and infer as to the nature of that thing that you're experiencing, particularly that you see the nature of it as impermanent, as suffering, and as not self. So when you see something in light of one or other or all of those characteristics, then this is the tirana parinya. And the final one is the pahana parinya, or the understanding by letting go. And pahana parinya means when you see the true nature of something, then you're able to let go of your attachments to it, your aversions to it. You can see it truly for what it is, but without getting caught up in it. And that's that, what I was talking about before, is that feeling of relief and that feeling of peace that comes when that knowing hits in and when that knowing becomes real and manifests in your mind. So these are three stages of insight. Knowing something, the jnana parinya, knowing something in and of itself. The tirana parinya is knowing it as impermanent suffering and not self. And finally, the pahana parinya, or knowing something in terms of letting go. And all of these are involved in the process of insight, and all of them you will use to develop insight. The specific things that will trigger and deepen insight and wisdom will vary between from person to person, and we can't control this. We see many examples of this in the suttas, especially in the Theragata and Therigata, where the monks and the nuns will talk about their own personal experiences of enlightenment. And you have one of the nuns who comes back to her hut and she turns out the lamp. And then when the lamp went out, then her mind was freed. Yeah, or the classic example of Venerable Ananda, who was trying to meditate and couldn't get enlightened, so eventually he thought, I'll have some rest, and he lay down on his pillow, and just as his head was about to hit the pillow, then he became enlightened. Yeah. So how that happens and how that manifests is mysterious, and we can't control that. This is why I don't really like the term insight meditation, because insight is not something that you can do. What you can do in your meditation is that you can meditate in a way that is helpful and conducive for the arising of insight. But you can't just sort of sit there and do insight meditation. It just doesn't work like that. You can't just program the development of insight in that kind of way. I mean, to a certain extent, there are certain things that you can do, just like if you're in a school, there's certain things you can do. You can systematize things to give people an education. But at the end of the day, how much somebody learns and where they're at with all that information is something that you can't really control. So this is a bit of background as to the theory of wisdom in Buddhism and how wisdom is developed. How we know when it works and when we know what is real wisdom and what isn't real wisdom. Also, it has, think back to the idea I mentioned before, that wisdom has some resilience and adaptability. So it's something that doesn't just give you a nice feeling in your meditation, but something that matters when you get up from your meditation seat and you go and talk to somebody or solve a problem or try to address something that actually happens to you. And wisdom is something that will be brought to those cases. And wisdom also knows that there are some things that you can't fix. And there are some things you just have to walk away from. We saw how the Buddha's wisdom, he just walked away from Kosambi. Yeah, because he couldn't do anything. He tried. That's it. I can't do anything. So, in terms of practically applying the meditation on wisdom for this retreat. Now, I haven't been primarily focusing on that in this retreat. We've been mainly focusing on the peace and the metta meditation. But if today or towards the end of the retreat, if you want to do some vipassana or some wisdom meditation, then that's great. If you're happy with the method that you've been using up to now, then that's great. Keep doing it. Otherwise, if you want to try another method, then may I suggest to try a method based on the six senses. And I might do a guided meditation for that this evening. And the meditation on the six senses, again, just to go through the senses, first thing to do is to get a clear idea of what they're like. Because normally the world that we experienced is a pre-processed world. And we see everything that's, it's like baked, right? We see the cake, we don't see the ingredients. Or if you're a geek, we see the web page, but now we want to go right-click, view source. And we want to see what is the code that makes the whole thing work. Right? So we just stop with one thing and we look at that. It doesn't matter what it is. And you just hold that one particular sense as long as you can. And this is why the development of samatha and peace of mind is so important, because it enables us to hold something and just look at it. Because the whole thing, like the whole thing of the senses, is that senses want to delude you. They want to convince you that you're living in this world that makes sense. And that all of this is somehow just is. But the more you look at it, the more you realize how weird it is. And how strange it is. And it starts to break down these concepts of wholeness and self. And all of those things which are in the... we normally assume are in the external world. So just contemplate each of those senses in turn and get a clear idea what is the quality of that, the experience of that. And when you've done that, then the next stage you can look at it is to look at them in terms of their causality and conditionality. Where do these things come from? How do they originate? And again, go through each of the senses in turn, spending a good long time with each sense, and just look at it and just apply yourself. You know, you look at your, for example, if you pay attention to sound in meditation, you know, you think that sound arises because there's a noise. Right? But of course that's, I mean, generally speaking, kind of true, but why is it that certain noises will annoy you and attract your attention and certain others don't? Why is it that sometimes you're not sure if you're hearing a noise outside you or if it's actually just a buzzing in your own head? Yeah, sometimes you can hear a voice and you're not sure if it's somebody else's voices or is this just a voice in your own head? And so that what seems to be something that's very simple and straightforward, actually we realize is much more complicated than it is. You realize that it's bound up with our own desire, our own wishes, our own greed, hate, and delusion, which is directing and shaping the form that that ear consciousness has. And so you start to understand the conditionality behind it. And when you can start to do that, then you can start to let go of it. And so the more that you do this and the longer you stay with these different senses, the more you see that these senses are empty, that they don't actually have any inherent nature. And you look at them and you realize, oh, that's all it is. And then you start to see through it, and you start to let go of it. And when you start to let go of it, the world becomes like, almost like ghosts. It's not quite right. It's almost like everything just moves through each other. And you realize that actually this world of solid and dependable things is just always changing and breaking and falling apart. And so, anyway, that's probably enough for now. So that's just a few words on wisdom in terms of the background of it, the theory of how we understand wisdom in the world, and the theory of how we understand wisdom in Buddhism and meditation practice, and a few tips on how to apply that in meditation. So I will leave you with that for now.